Good. I'm going to show you a very theologically and academically astute picture. So it's a cartoon with two seagulls.
Do you think the owl is a predator, one says to the other? Of course not. He's never bothered me. Exactly. No idea what Mr. Mouse was going on about.
So this is a perfect example of how we do theology. It is a cartoon or a window into biblical hermeneutics, that is the study and interpretation of the Bible. Because we interpret from our context, from our world, from our lens and from our worldview. We've established that, and that's what we've been doing the last couple of weeks. And so we ask ourselves, is the owl a predator? The seagulls, obviously, don't think the owl is a predator. They're sitting there drinking their tea, all very happy. The owl doesn't disturb us. We don't know what Mr. Mouse is on about because he hasn't affected us, our species, our tribe, our group of animals. The owl is not a predator. I don't know what Mr. Mouse is talking about. And when we come to the Bible, we read it through our lens, through our context, through our humanity, and also our tribe, who we are as a group, who we are made up of. And so when we begin to see the world and the Bible through other people's lens, other people's experience, the experience of Mr. Mouse, then we have a humility towards the world, towards each other, towards the Bible, which opens us up to difference. It opens up to other people's experience. And that's why we looked at Mark chapter 5 a few weeks ago, the story of the man that was enslaved to Legion. And we looked at it through a post-colonial lens. And this week we'll be doing the first part of another story. It'll only be a brief foray into that story. I'm going to set an agenda, first of all, about what we want to do. And then in a couple of weeks' time, we're going to have more discussion around the actual passage itself. And it's looking at John chapter 9. So if you could turn to it in your Bibles, please. And we're looking at this passage through the lens of disability theology. A disability hermeneutic. And this kind of hermeneutics and this kind of theological investigation is sometimes called theology from the margins. It's trying to understand what other voices that haven't been heard before or are being listened to more and more are able to arrest and reinterpret the lens of the many. The lens of the acceptable viewpoint and worldview of theology. And a disability hermeneutic is not just theology from the margins. Disability theology is for everyone. And just as we have critiqued whiteness a few weeks ago, and the consequences and effect of whiteness, so us who are able-bodied need to listen and learn from the diverse voices of the disability community, both as Christians and in the world at large. And this is a vast and diverse subject. I'm sure you understand that. And so this is only really just a brief insight and discussion later on about what this whole concept means and what we're trying to achieve. First of all, a disclaimer. As an able-bodied person, as a person who someone said, you have stacked privilege. Now, they didn't point that to me, but stacked privilege is a list of privileges which we have as people which stack up, obviously. And as a white, non-rich white guy, but rich in the sense because anybody that lives in this world at this time in this place is rich compared to the global south and other areas of the world. We are rich, and of course, that stacks us up in terms of our privilege, and it gives us a worldview and an insight which sometimes blinds us. There, I've used a word already. So I am not attempting to speak on behalf of people with a disability. I do not claim to speak with a lived experience of disability, either disability or a debilitating illness or a neurodiverse condition. And I know many of you do experience directly and from families and from friends that experience different forms of disability and impairment. The nearest thing that we've got to it as a family, I suppose, has been Lorna's recent arthritis diagnosis and the management of pain, what that looks like on a daily basis. And that's exposed us in part to the limitations or the evolving nature of health. Because, of course, we can never presume in our state of where I am as an able-bodied person as I am now, that won't still be the case in 5-10 years' time. That's what age does. Now, there are all sorts of, there's a spectrum of, debilitating illness, disability, impairment, all those kind of things. But getting older exposes us to the possibility of changes in our mind and our cognitive ability and our physical abilities as well. And many of you will be exposed to that, and you will be exposed in the coming years as many of your parents get older as well. How fun that's going to be, looking after elderly parents. So this is why disability theology is for everyone. And it is another area of life, sadly, the church has long gone got wrong. And the church, including us here at BGMC, have been exposed to learning and listening and trying to understand and act. And we haven't always got it right. And we still aren't getting it right. But this building that we sit in is a result of a period of grappling about what it means for a diverse group of people to have access, to have a sense of belonging. So the church is on a learning curve, and I think the pandemic exposed the church and the rest of society to the failings about addressing the needs of the disability community, but also gave us opportunities to understand what that means going forward. I know it's not just about the physical space, of course. I think the physical space is merely both a symptom and a symbol of the ignorance in culture, in language, in perception, and in theology that exists in our world and in the church. And as we know, we live in a world that is built to serve certain kind of bodies and certain types of people. We live in an ableist environment and culture. That's the reality. There is a unspoken hierarchy in society where certain physical, mental and cognitive abilities are ranked higher and seen as having more value and worth. We talk about what is normal. I was in the cafe on Thursday and someone said they wanted normal milk, and then they suddenly changed their language to dairy milk. No, we are getting more and more aligned with language, which we know is perhaps sometimes unhelpful, and it's a messy process, and the language development of any society changes all the time, but we're trying to understand what normality looks like, because normality in the whole realm of things often looks like what is healthy, what is good, what is acceptable, and what is not normal, like oat milk, is just weird. Is not just different, but not normally seen as deficient or less than, of course. And so value judgments are all around us. Now, I've got to confess my pet prejudice. It's not a pet prejudice, because that sort of things that you look after your prejudice and care for it. Perhaps I do. My prejudice against mobility scooters. Not just because one of our favourite Beehive customers is on a mobility scooter. Well, he is at the moment, but he's not a customer because he's been banned. No, not. I would like to stress that, not just because he's on a mobility scooter, no, and that's separate from his disability, honestly. So you're dragging me into a whole world of prejudice here.
You're going to have to edit
that. Yeah, we're going. Other people are available, yes, okay. So, yeah. So as we go into our prejudices about mobility scooters and indeed making value judgments, we realise that actually there's a hidden dialogue. This is what prejudice does, of course, a mental dialogue in our brain that's making a judgment about who they are and what they do and why they're here. They look okay. Why are they on a mobility scooter? They look fine. There's nothing wrong with them. They're just lazy. Why don't they work? Why don't they go down, you know, off the pavement onto the road? Blah, 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 blah. And we find ourselves in a world, because it's an ableist environment and culture, being drawn into the prejudice which exists in society. And that feeds into the wider societal narrative that health and fitness is a virtue. That somehow we've done something to be healthy. That it is something that we've done when we've ate well. Or we keep ourselves fit. We play football, or we do ballet, or we go out for a run, or we swim. We have our five a day. We drink 5 litres of water. We are healthy because we are virtuous and active. And fitness becomes then a moral category. And that is why there is something deeply toxic and dangerous about the wellness industry. We are well because we've done the right things. We've achieved our good health. And conversely, of course, the other side of that narrative is the loading of ill health, sickness, impairment, disability, with moral failing, with fault, with blame, and in a toxic spirituality, with a lack of faith. And so part of this journey, of course, in disability theology, is to decenter health, fitness, and able-bodiedness from virtue, from being what is normative, and to challenge the notions of worth and value which are bound up in the proper normal functioning of our bodies and minds. There's a biblical scholar which I've quoted before called Charlotte Naylor Davis, who's done some work on the medical and the social models of disability. And I'm just going to put a couple of slides up here because I don't want to go into too much. But some of these headlines about the medical model is that someone who's disabled, they have a medical impairment. The problem is with the body of the person. The thing that needs to be fixed is the body of the person. And then other people get to decide how disabled that person is. The perfect disabled person is the one that causes no bother to society. The person is required to change, and health is the most good state to be in and defined in comparison to the perfect body, either the benefits and productivity. And anybody that has done an application on behalf of someone to apply for PIP will understand how productivity and health and disability becomes about capitalism. About feeds in how efficient and productive you are as a person. And so these are all complex matters bound up in our capitalist culture, because we value efficiency and productivity, and we measure people of how functioning they are in that realm of life. And then the social model moves people towards an experience where the problem is with society and how it's organised. It's not with the body, but the environment the person to find themselves in. And then the person gets to define the disability based on the circumstances they are in and requires society to change. But there is also, tied up with this, a religious functioning and model of what disability looks like. And part of looking at the Bible through a disability hermeneutic is wrestling, like we did with the post-colonial lens, with seeing how we can centre the disability community and disabled people as we read the text, as we understand the story. And we know that language is messy and loaded and can be a symptom of our ignorance and also a vehicle for harm. And so we've got to be careful about that. And as we approach the Bible, we understand that the ancient world and the culture of the ancient world, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, understanding disability is complex. We've got to be careful about achronisms, that is, reading our modern medical understanding of bodies into an ancient text, into the ancient world. And the relationship between sickness and health and religion and culture is very nuanced. And the root cause of sickness and health is very complex, especially in relation to morality and sin, likewise for healing and cure. And also, we've got to be conscious that when we read the Bible out loud with stories, particularly in the Gospels, about sickness and healing, which are negative about disability and positive about healing, we've got to be cautious about who hears those stories. When we presume that it's always a good thing for that disability to be healed. Similarly to our post-colonial lens, when we saw whiteness as a normative standard for approaching the Bible, so has able-bodiedness become a normal way to read the Bible through that lens. And it's understanding the stacked privilege of our able-bodiedness. And our able-bodiedness, as whiteness has been validated and mandated through religious language and theology. And that's seen in a whole range of stories in the Bible, but particularly in the Gospels. And it doesn't take much, of course, for us to read the stories of Jesus and see people being healed, made well, whole in their bodily functioning, in their mind, in their physicality. And we read into it that that is ideal. It's needed, it's required for the functioning of people to experience life in their fullness. And in the Gospels, we see at the very beginning of the mandate of Jesus that he's here to release captives and to give sight to the blind. Those who are ill, sick, blind, deaf, demon-possessed are liberated, healed, made whole, they're fixed from their brokenness. They're cured. And we say that is good news. But seen through a disability lens and hermeneutic, it can be a challenge to that normative understanding of able-bodiedness. Because it creates, and the possibility of creating, a template for certain types of human experience which are aspirational, which are virtuous, and which is right. You see, in the realm of Christian theology and sickness and health and impairment and disability, we often see those things as a problem to be fixed. And that was summed up perhaps in the title of a book by a disabled scholar called Amy Kenney that said, "My body is not a prayer request." And one of the things that we were talking about on Wednesday night, because Bernie had raised this issue a little bit with the book she's reading by Dorothy Rowe on siblings, I think it is, isn't it, Bernie? What does the reconciliation of all things look like, and the wholeness and healing of all things, including our bodies, including creation, including everything within the created order, when sometimes disability and trauma and wounds make us who we are? Is death the end of that human identity, and are we given a brand new one? What is the legacy of disability in heaven? Now, of course, we're not going to be able to answer these things, but they ask ourselves a question about what it means for life right now. Is a reconciled creation going to have those things in it, which is a hopeful and reassuring vision, of course, but it may be problematic when we're talking about wholeness in this world right now, when we compare being fixed as something that's going to happen And does that undermine wholeness in our life, which has impairment, disability, and illness? And particularly in a society which elevates our normality according to production, efficiency, and functioning. And of course, we know that the biblical language for things like blindness and deafness are metaphors for sin and ignorance and unbelief and stubbornness. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see. Now, we're not going to change the lyrics for those, as we have done in the past, of course, to some lyrics. But that is a classic song which uses the concept of blindness as a response to a previous existence of wretchedness. And being able to see is almost a moral category. Of course, we use that language all the time. When we shout at the TV, or when I do, and say, "Are you blind, ref?" We're making a moral judgment of a guy that hasn't seen a clear foul, obviously. Or an offside. And now we have VAR, we don't need to worry about that kind of thing. It's the people in VAR that are blind, as well as the ref. Disability theology, therefore, disrupts our theology of health and healing. So, you've been waiting for this. We're actually going to get to a Bible passage now. That was a long introduction to John 9. And actually, it is such a long passage because it's 41 verses. We're only actually going to look at four. Okay, and then in a couple of weeks' time, we're going to look at the rest of the story. And in our minds, I wanted to consider a couple of things. This is for a few weeks' time. What issues of disability are in this passage and in this story? And what theological problems arise? And you may get certainly the second question very easily in the first few verses. So turn to John chapter 9, please. And I'm going to read these first few verses just on the screen. As he went along, that is Jesus, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" "Neither this man nor his parents sinned," said Jesus. "But this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. As long as it is day, we must do the works of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work." So we're trying to read this through the lens of the disability community, people that have a disability. And this man has a congenital impairment. He's blind. And the disciples reflect on the man's status and his moral character. There is a stigma already attached to his disability. They assume that the blindness is a result of sin, either his parents or himself. And Jesus, straight away, challenges that logic, separates the sin from the disability. He says, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned." However, what Jesus then goes on to say actually makes the whole sequence even more problematic and baffling and theologically confusing. Because he says, okay, this man didn't sin, nor his parents, but this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. A couple of other the translations said, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned. He was born blind so that God's works might be revealed in him." And then, "This happened essentially as a result of God's need to show off his power and his glory." So it's not the man's fault. It seems to be God's fault. Did God cause the blindness in the man with the sole purpose of using it as a prop in a divine magic show? What kind of God, we may ask, justifies doing a work a miracle work, a work of glory, so his power can be demonstrated. And so despite lots and lots of theological manoeuvring and preachers and teachers over the years, it's still not a good look, shall we say. Thankfully, there is more going on in this than you can see on face value. And this is where the nerd alert comes in, because Bernie had a nerd alert last week. This is going a deeper dive into nerdness, okay? So you've got to stick with me on this, because this is... Am I really? That's a good point, actually. Yeah. Okay. What? I don't come up with an alternative, Bernie. Okay, so... So we're going to look at some of the Greek in this passage in order for us to understand the theological consequences of what Jesus has said right then as a response to the disciples making a judgment about the man's moral character or the parent's moral character in relation to his disability. You've got to remember, first of all, as we all know, but I'll remind you anyway, that translators of the Bible, the manuscripts they used, the Greek manuscripts, have no spaces in between the words. There is no punctuation in Greek. There is no upper or lower case. And of course, there's no chapter and verses. So all of these variations, all of these insertions, all of the punctuation are decisions made by translators, obviously, in order for a Greek text to be understood in English or whatever language it's translated in. That's just, you know, Greek 101, okay? And so these decisions often change not only the language in order for it to be acceptable and be read in English, but they have theological consequences. And we'll come on to that in a moment. I'm going to show you the actual Greek text of how it is written in the Greek manuscripts. And I'm going to read it out and it will make no sense at all. Okay. Answered Jesus, neither this man sinned, neither the parents of him, but so, or in order that, might be displayed the works of God in him, we must work the works of him who sent me as long as day, it is coming, night, when no one can or is able to work. You got that? Makes perfect sense. Thank you. Okay. So if we look at these two highlighted words, which are Greek words, which Greek word for but, which is alla, and another word, sequence of words, which is so, or in order that, which is hinna, these are conjunctives. They're conjunction. That means they are connecting words. They connect before and after the sequence of the sentences. Okay, so they help the clause to move either back or forward. And the translators have taken that but and so in order in its proper use as a conjunction, but they've linked it with the blindness as an explanation of cause. So are you getting this so far? And so therefore they've used that perfectly legitimately, and then they've actually inserted the words, he was born blind, or in other translations, this happened, and then add on, so that. So they've added words in order for it to make sense. They've connected, therefore, the man's blindness with God's work of glory in a miracle. And that is an interpretation in the process of doing that work of punctuation and inserting new words. And of course, there are massive theological consequences for this, because the words, he was born blind and this happened because, are not in the Greek text. They're not there. They're not there. So if I had my Greek New Testament here, you would be able to look at that and you would see exactly like that. But he was born blind was added in by translators in order for him to make sense, of course. But what it does in making it sense, it adds a theological conundrum and problem, or an explanation in the translators' minds, which isn't necessarily right or helpful or good. There's a guy called Scott McKnight that says every translator is a traitor. And there is a lot of treachery going on in this passage. Let us do something different with the punctuation and not add some words. And we can legitimately do this because it is the way that translation and Greek works. We can say this. As he went along, he saw a man born blind from birth. This is, we haven't changed this at all. His disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, neither did this man nor his parents. Full stop. Full stop. So we're inserting a full stop. We're not inserting a semicolon or a colon to connect with what's next, as the Greek translators do. But we are going on to a new verse which says but. And the but can be there or it doesn't have to be there at all. But so that the works of God may be displayed in him, we must do the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. Do you see how that changes everything? A change of the punctuation, not inserting the words he was born blind because, or this happened because. What we're doing is changing the words, the punctuation mainly, and changes everything. Because it moves the work of God not back to the man's condition as an explanation, but forward to Jesus' work and what he will do in partnership with God in that moment. The cause of the man's blindness is totally removed. The man doesn't need God to use him as a prop for the divine magic show in order to demonstrate his glory. Now, this is not Greek gymnastics in order for me to get over a theological conundrum. This is legitimate translation, opting to have another translation which takes us down the path of a new theological understanding of cause of blindness in relation to how God works. The punctuation change and the removal of the words leaves the disciples' question actually unanswered, which is not untypical of Jesus, of course. But what it does, it emphasizes what happens next. Let's do God's work by looking after this man, Jesus is saying. Jesus is making the point, we have the choice to do the works of God now in this moment with this man before us, while we can, while it is day, while we're in the world to display God's work and wonder. And he's saying to the disciples, will you do that with me? He's challenging them not to think about the man's blindness in relation to God's work, but actually how the man can be helped in this moment. And a book I would recommend on this, and there are many, many of them, is called The Bible and Disability, A Commentary. And I recommend that for anybody who would like to have a look into some many different passages in the Old and New Testament in relation to a disability hermeneutic. And they say this in relation to this passage. Reading the text this way, we see Jesus moving away from an obsession with determining whose fault the man's impairment was, whether the man's, the parents, or God's. It is simply a fact the man is born blind. The reality is he continues to be blind at that moment. While the disciples busy themselves with an academic exercise in theological hair splitting, here sits a person, not a case, with an impairment. Even if they were able to determine whose fault it is, which they can't, of course, it does not change the fact the man cannot see. Jesus turns them away from speculating about the past, focuses in their gaze on the person in front of them, and asks them to consider whether or not they're going to work for and with God or themselves. Jesus definitively declares and demonstrates that for his part, he will work for God. So the man is centered, not for being part of God's supernatural freak show, or as an object lesson for the disciples' curiosity and questioning, but for being a willing participant in the unfolding story of God's work in the world. What we'll see happen in a couple of weeks' time is how this story impacts family and the religious community and their response to him. So, before Bernie comes and shares a final prayer for us, as the story of the legion and the man with the legion led us to consider, quite uncomfortably, I think, our need to be exorcised of our whiteness, perhaps this story, and as it unfolds, will convict us of the need to be healed and repentant of our ableism. Bernie, over to you.
So this is Disability Glorified, a Prayer by Katie Stenter. Ableism kills. Jesus, you were not ableist. What kind of diagnoses did your 12 disciples have? Who limped? Who was ugly? Who had voices? Who had ADD or autism or OCD? As you healed and were asked, what sin was committed that this person is blind? The people asked, and then our Saviour said, none, neither he nor his parents. And then Jesus, you touched lepers, those who were lame or blind or bled, the poor, the oddly shaped and the dirty, the ones who humans avoided even looking at, because in our heart of hearts, we are so scared of disabilities that we avoid eye contact, afraid of catching it, embarrassed that we still, even today, do not know how to interact with people who exist differently than us. In some ways, Jesus' resurrection might be the scariest thing of all. Jesus, you were young and healthy and died anyway, and the disciples, of course, fled death, except for the women, who probably had the most intimate relationship with death and dead bodies. Jesus, the good news is not just that you returned, but you returned with holes in your arms and legs, but were still wholly you, but unchanged. You were still perfect, but your body was still yours. What hope for those with disabilities? It leads us to ask, are there wheelchairs and mobility aids in heaven? Is it a place where your body is not weighty and there is no more pain, but you are still you? Are those with dyslexia, ADD, OCD, bipolar, Down syndrome, autism and more, are beloved and understood? Jesus, I'm so thankful that you got it, that you get it, that ableism kills, that you do not promise wealth and health, that you do not need our bodies to be perfect for us to enter heaven. Jesus is not ableist. And maybe Thomas wasn't either. And as sure as the holes remained in Jesus' sacred body, holes that I'm invited to touch whenever I doubt or feel alone or scared of my own imperfections, I can breathe in, Jesus wasn't ableist. And breathe out, Jesus affirms all people. Thank God for the risen, holy, whole-e body. Amen.